All right, everybody. Can you everybody hear and see me okay? I'm a little my elevation is a little odd because of my back is apparently if you sit too much in meditation, you can hurt your back. So I have a Dharma injury, which is kind of embarrassing to admit, but I'm not a spring chicken anymore. So I'm kind of standing a little bit. So happy to be here. Want to spend just send a great debt of gratitude to Sangha Live. I've been teaching here kind of since the beginning, back before it was, I forget, it was something else before it was Sangha Live, but, and I usually teach about once a year. Lots of folks are trying to get on the platform because it's such a great platform and they do such a great job offering such good Dharma to people all over the world and their website. You can watch the recordings. And so I just want to give them props for holding it together and doing a good job. Because navigating the digital world is not always so easy or fun. I don't know that we're going to have a lovely practice today because the topic is a little bit charged, mindfulness in the addiction economy. So I do have a little bit of a public service announcement that you are already all aware of anyway. I'm just going to put it in stark terms. And so what I'll do is I'm just going to kind of give you a little bit of an overview about the topic. Then we'll do a guided meditation, and then I'll do a talk, and then we'll have some questions and answers. I can't guarantee there'll be any answers, but I hope there'll certainly be some questions. And in fact, at the end of our time today, I hope you leave with more questions than answers. That tends to work better for most of us, actually. So where to begin? So there is an idea in Buddhism I just want to point to that I generally don't teach, but I think it's relevant here. It's sometimes called the two truth theory, the idea that there's an ultimate truth and a relative truth. The main reason I don't teach that is all of the Dharma teachings that I teach are generally rooted in what's called the Pali Canon or the Pali Text, which is really early Buddhism, which is very pre-Theravada, actually. And the idea around the two truths really emerges in the Abhidharma, and really much more so in the Zen tradition. And then we see a lot of it in the Theravada because of the work of the Visuddhimagga. I want to just kind of offer a reframe on this one because I think it's interesting. I think it's unhelpful when we start making level systems and experience, like there's the ultimate and the relative, and it kind of can be a way to control people, those who have access to the ultimate truth. And also, the word truth can be unhelpful because nobody seems to have the, nobody really knows what the truth is. It's very kind of a moving target, isn't it? But this idea of what I would call the two-world theory, I want to introduce to you today, that comes more from philosophy and modern philosophy, is that we it kind of play on the movie The Matrix. We kind of live in two worlds, right? There's the world that which is really out there, loka in Buddhist terms, loka, the world of society, the world of different countries. You know, the world that mostly comes to us through this little digital device, which I happily don't have in my possession at the moment. You know, there's a world that which is really out there. And, you know, I'm not denying that it is out there. I believe that. But I think what happened is we're a little bit addicted to that world two, I would call. And then there's world one, which is kind of the Vipassana world or the Dharma world, which is the world of lived experience, the world of present time awareness. The world of the four foundations of mindfulness, the world of the body, the world of feelings, the world of mental states, the world of ideas. Now, when we practice insight or any kind of Buddhist meditation, frankly, we're really trying to tune into that first world experience that I'm sitting in my office, I'm breathing, I'm in my body, I feel actually pretty comfortable at the moment. I'm probably drank too much coffee, so I'm a little bit excited. And that's really what's going on. So, my kind of a general assessment or encouragement today is that I think all of us would do a lot better if we really try to take more care of the first world experience, taking care of our hearts, taking care of our minds, taking care of ourselves. And it's really hard to do that because we get addicted. We get sucked into this other thing. We get sucked into society. We get sucked into politics. We get sucked into polarization. You know, we get sucked into all kinds of things that we, for the most part, don't even know probably much about. Because, you know, we've also are confused in the modern times. We confuse information with knowledge. We are inundated with endless amounts of information, which honestly, pardon my language, most of it's probably total bullshit. And so we're swimming in this digital ocean of bullshit. And, you know, and I don't know about you, but I get caught up in it. This is like half my practice is trying to not get caught up in all of the he said, they did, they're going to do. Oh, God. Oh, my God. This Chicken Little, this guy is falling. And it's really, really hard, actually. I have to work really hard to kind of put that aside. And I'm not dismissing it. I'm not saying that's not important. I'm just saying it's exhausting. And also the truth of the matter is I really can't do much about it. The Dalai Lama speaks to this in great detail in his book Beyond Religion, which is a book on secular ethics, where, you know, when you ask him, how do we change the world? How do we change these big political systems and climate change and systemic racism and all the problems of the world that were just really out there? It's one person at a time. It's one person at a time, which I know is probably not a very exciting idea. It's going to probably take a long time, but it's one person at a time, and it starts with us. It starts with you. It starts with me. It starts right here. It starts right now. How can we become more kind? How can we become more generous? How can we embody these Dharma qualities that we all totally feel connected to? And on a generosity tip, and we'll do a practice, I promise I won't rant the whole time. You know, especially here in America, if like 25 people had a Grinch moment and a change of heart, if 25 people or so like decided to be generous, like we could save the world tomorrow, you know? And so the power of these practices is really, really good. And the world right now does not need more suffering people. And so as practitioners, for those of us who hopefully take the Dharma seriously, we really sometimes have to rethink about why we're doing this in the first place. And really, you know, I'll talk about this in the talk. How do we and are we willing to really take full responsibility for our experience? Take full responsibility for my own reactivity, for what's going on inside of my body, my mind, my heart, taking care of this instead of blaming the struggle that I'm experiencing internally on external circumstances, which right now is real easy to do. And I'm not on my high horse here. I do. This is like the reason I want to talk about this. This is my welcome to my mind. This is the stuff that I deal with every day. So I thought it would be, I do a practice that's generally called Metta Vipassana, which I've done here many times, which is really about insight practice, but more about starting with this kind of kindness, this metta, this sense of ease, and then bringing that into kind of an insight practice. So that way we can really have this internal experience of ease, of well-being, dare I say. And that this well-being, this ease, this what the Buddha called Nibbana, is available all the time. You know, liberation is under your nose 24/7. You know, and that's a really, I think, encouraging idea right now. The freedom that we're looking for in the Dharma, it's never really that far away. It's just right here. It's just all the subtraction that we have to do in our minds to get back to this basic state of well-being, of I'm here, I'm breathing, I'm okay right now. And that's that mindfulness, remembering. It's mindfulness is a reminder that you're okay. And I need to remind myself that 100 times a day, 200 times a day. So you can find a comfortable way to sit if that's available to you. It's not totally available to me, so don't judge me. I'm going to be squirming the whole time. And I think I could turn off this. Okay, that's good. All right, so I will start and end with the bell. You can find a comfortable way to sit. So again, just allowing your attention to come out of the cognitive, conceptual dimension of experience and coming right into the somatic felt sense of the body here seated. And seeing if you can fully connect with your direct experience just as it is. And seeing if you can just pour your mind, fully pour the mind into the body. And as you tune into the felt sense of the body, just connecting with all of the breathing related sensations in areas where the breathing is strongly pronounced, the chest or the belly. Breathing in, rising, falling with the out breath. And even noticing breathing in more subtle locations, the hollow space of the mouth, releasing any tension at the neck or throat. You may even notice the left end of the right shoulder. They lift ever so slightly with the in-breath. So just tuning into all of the various sensations that are related to breathing, as you continue to connect more intentionally with the body. And then allowing your awareness to rest or connect with the area at or around your heart center. starting by softening all of the tension in the body from the chin to the belly button. So starting at the tip of the chin, moving down and letting go of any tension or tightness that you might be holding in your neck or throat. Tuning into the rising, lifting, expanding with the in-breath of the chest. Letting that area just come and go as naturally as you can. And then letting the belly be soft, softening the belly. So you're just scanning up and down from the chin to the belly button, softening outward, softening outward. Letting go of any tension or tightness. And however you do so, as you come into contact with the heart experience at the area at and around the heart center, seeing if you can really allow yourself to recognize or to feel into your own wish or your own simple desire to be free. To be free, to be at ease, to be content, or even just your own deepest wish or desire to just be okay in this world. And so beginning to recognize that there can be a simple desire or a well-wishing, a sense of goodwill. Just let your awareness tune into that. Let that become the object of practice here. May I be at ease? May I be okay? May I be content in this moment just as it is? Just let your mind really absorb into that intention, wish, desire, however that shows up for you. Just really let yourself soak into that. And then just becoming aware, being mindful when your attention becomes consumed or caught up in the plans of the week ahead, regrets or concerns about the week behind you, all of the concerns and worries we have about the world or our lives. See if you can just put that aside for now. All of the ways in which we talk ourselves out of being free, being at ease. All of the reasons why I'm not okay. Just as an act of kindness, an act of generosity, just you can even let that just sit right beside you. Just put it aside for now. As stated in the mindfulness teachings, putting aside our desires and discontents in regards to the world, we just focus on an inherent sense of well-being that we can allow ourselves to connect with here, now, in this moment, in the body, in the breath, and getting in touch with even this most basic intention of goodwill, well-wishing. And if you're able to sense or recognize this, just let your attention dwell there. And if the mind is distracted or caught up, you can just use this simple phrase to come back. May I be at ease? May I be okay? May I be content in this moment just as it is right now? Just for right now. May I cultivate and practice a basic okayness, a goodwill. And really this, just taking care of ourselves, just for now, taking good care, attending, breathing, resting. And this unhooking from all of the unhelpful, destructive tendencies that we get caught up in so much of the time. And for the last 5 minutes of the practice here together this morning, to just see if you can really allow yourself to be fully present, to be fully connected with your experience just as it is, however it is, and to see if you can be friendly or to at least be at ease with whatever it is that arises. I'm here. It's okay to be here. Present. At ease. It's a nice, ordinary kind of liberation. Non-reactive. All right, everybody, thank you for your kind attention and for your practice here this morning, this evening, or this afternoon, whatever the case may be for you. All of a sudden, with the Zoom world, the present moment's gotten real tricky. Everybody seems to be in a different one. As we talk about this mindfulness in the addiction economy, I want to just kind of start off simple. And that is pointing to something that actually comes right out of the mindfulness teaching in the refrain. Some of you probably know that the mindfulness teachings are usually taught as the four foundations of mindfulness: body, feelings, mental states, and ideation. And they're rooted in a discourse called the Satipatthana Sutta, in which many books have been written. A lot of people have been studying this teaching for quite some time. It's kind of the Bible of the insight tradition at this point. It's quite good. But there's a kind of a request that the Buddha makes, that he makes in the refrain, which he's kind of restating it, which he says, to put aside your desires and your discontents in regards to the world. Now, when he uses the world, he's using the Pali term loka, which isn't the world of direct experience, isn't what's happening in my direct mind-body system. The world is that which is really out there. It's Crete, it's Los Angeles, it's Vancouver, it's Colorado. We're all in different parts of the world. I believe you are all out there, but he's saying to put, he's not saying to repress it. He's not saying to get rid of it. He's not saying that it doesn't matter. He's just saying, put it aside. Because if you don't put aside your desires and discontents about the world, you're not going to be able to practice. Now, how many of you noticed in the last 25 minutes during the practice when you attempted to do that, that you noticed thoughts that were desirous, things I want from the world, things I'm unhappy about the world? I mean, that's basically what we think about, the things, you know, and that's the general position we take. Happiness, well-being, the delusion we're sold is accomplished through me getting what I want and avoiding what I don't want. And most people wake up every day and that's their strategy for life. How do I get what I want? How do I avoid what I don't want? And the sad tragedy of this operational mechanism is there's a lot of people out there who are willing to do some pretty horrible things to other people to get what they want and to avoid what they don't want. And so when we put that aside, we can really tune in to what's going on in our direct experience and take this radical responsibility for our lives, for our actions, for our beliefs, for our behaviors, through the words that we choose to use. Taking this responsibility, which is really the ethical sila dimension of Dharma practice. And I like this because it's not lightweight. This is pretty, the Buddha's kind of position is pretty staunch, where he's really saying, we're making a claim that I actually like, is I'm refusing to let my internal sense of happiness be dictated by external demands. That I can only be happy if the external world is arranged in such a way that I feel good about that. That's going to be a long time. There's a long waiting room. And he's saying to put that aside and to see, I'm going to take full responsibility for this, for what's going on inside my direct experience. And not only that, I refuse to let my happiness be dictated by that, but I also refuse to let my suffering be dictated by that. You know? And again, it's not this cold, I don't care. It's not apathy. It's not indifference. It's just going to be more helpful to me and the people I come into contact with if I can become a beacon, or I can become a possible that you can live in the world, you can live in this messy world and actually be okay. Because let's be clear about one thing. The world that the Buddha lived in ancient India was not a peaceful place. There was genocide, there was the caste system, there were tyrant leaders doing horrible shit all the time. The world of ancient India was, especially towards the end of his life, the Buddha had to like leave and get away. People were being murdered and there was genocide. It was like totally falling apart. It was kind of worse than what we're dealing with on many levels. And he was still making this, you can still practice in the context of that. In many ways, we could say that this is kind of business as usual. You know, this is, you know, if you look at world history, you know, it's not rated, it's not a Disney movie, you know what I mean, by any stretch. And so how do we practice with that? We practice with that by trying to cultivate these inner qualities in and of ourselves. And the whole, what are the school of Buddhism that you practice? I think the whole training, the whole Dharma training is really an anti-addiction cognitive exercise. You know, there's nothing more anti-addiction than Buddhist meditation. And so what do I mean by that? Well, the first thing that we deal with, and this is true in all forms of Buddhist meditation and really all different systems of psychology, is it's really about attention. You know, it's about training one's attention. And that just needs to happen. So the one thing the Buddha is clear about is whatever you do with your mind, you're going to have to train it. You can't just let your mind do what it wants to do. You're going to have to really train this thing to behave appropriately, you know. And a lot of us, we have different ways of doing that. Everybody's mind is a bit different, but I have found it to be pretty difficult. So we train the attention, and then we see that we actually can do that. So, like, just to give you an example, like, I was just sitting here with you, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and I try to put my attention on the rise and fall of my in and out breath, or I try to tune into a heart-based object, trying to feel into my wish or desire to be free. And, you know, I can do that pretty good. And then I do that for a little while, but I can only do that for a certain amount of time. What happens is world two shows up. My desires and discontents about the world show up, and they hook into my attention and they sweep me away. It's almost like a scroll. They scroll me out and I get caught up in whatever that is. And we can kind of talk about that in a polite way, like, oh, the mind is wandering and we think about the past, and we think about the future. But I'm sorry, man, that is addiction. I mean, to me, the most fundamental addiction I have is that to my thinking mind. I haven't been able to give that one up forever. I mean, we just sat for 25 minutes. I probably relapsed 17 times. You know, I'm always getting in. So that's a really strong stream. And I'll tell you what, if I let it go on for too long, it rarely takes me anywhere good. You know, there was an article, actually they've debunked it now, but there was an article written in the early 2000s that said a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. And for most people, mind wandering, whether it goes on for 5 minutes or 12 minutes or 20 years, when we get to the end of whatever you get to the end of, you just end up feeling kind of bad because it doesn't really go anywhere. Because what happens, you pop out of it and there you are. It's just you again, sitting in your home, doing this little mindfulness drill. And so that's really what kind of gets us caught up. Now, for years and years, there used to be in Silicon Valley, for those of you who are, I'm sure everybody's familiar with this invention called the internet. And so a lot of this came out of Silicon Valley, and they used to have this really, I almost would dare I use the word evil mechanisms. It was what they used to call the attention economy. Now, the attention economy is a math equation where you have, let's use America, you have 350 million people times 1,440 minutes a day times however 60 seconds. So you do this little math equation and you get this gigantic number that's like, okay, there's, you know, 400 trillion moments of attention every day. And how do we get, and the question becomes, we need to get the most of those. So they develop all these evil little algorithms, and everybody's competing for your attention, trying to get as many moments of attention as possible so they can sell them to advertisers and turn them into products so you can get a, you know, whatever. How many times have you gotten a box delivered to your house from something you ordered online and you don't even remember ordering it? So, you know, we're not in the attention economy anymore. We're in the addiction economy. The attention economy is over. We lost. And now we're just living. And everybody knows this. We know this. This isn't headline news. You know, nobody seems to want to admit to it. Nobody seems to want to take responsibility for it. But yet, you know, we all seem to kind of accept it. I know that I do. And so the reason why this is on my mind is I also spend a lot of most of my career, not so much nowadays, thank God, doing Dharma work in the addiction space, which is also the trauma space. And I just did in the last month, I just did two things simultaneously that was a kind of a big wake-up call for me. I went to Alaska to present at an addiction conference and to do some training for the state of Alaska, which was very unpleasant. And then I went and taught a Buddhist meditation retreat at Southern Dharma, which was very pleasant. And it just reminded me, you know, addiction and trauma is just like, people are just getting, the suffering is almost impossible to bear. And we really haven't made any progress. You know, we have all these sophisticated advanced methodologies and different trauma therapies and stuff that's all effective. But you know what? If you're a traumatized drug addict, if you're unhoused, you're not getting access to any of that shit. Right? So nobody has access. And it was just like, I left Alaska, I was totally depressed. Not to mention that it was just, you know, it was like, I was up there for 5 days. I never saw the sun, nor I never saw the darkness. And I came back and taught my annual retreat at Southern Dharma. And it was just really, in many ways, depressing. And also just this willingness, or not this willingness, this unwillingness that's really big in the States right now. And I think it happens a lot with young people. And it happens for probably good reason, so I don't want to be judgmental, but people just don't want to take responsibility for themselves anymore. You know, it's like the blaming. It's like, you know, like everything I do is because of these external factors. It's very anti-Buddhist, actually. And it's just like, I think it's with good reason, but it makes me sad because, you know, we can do better than that. You know, and the one thing about Dharma practice, it's so beautiful. It's so empowering. It's such a can-do thing, no matter what you've been through. And that's one of the benefits of working in the trauma addiction space. The stories of the thing, you know, in the last 25 years that I've been doing this, the stories of things that people have been through, the horrifying shit that people went through in their childhood and their teen years. I've seen so many people go through stuff that they wouldn't put in a Tarantino movie. And they come out the other side, right? Because they get sober, or they get a Dharma practice, or they turn it all around. The redemption that is available to us as a result of doing a practice like this is just unbelievable. And to not feel like you have access to that, to talk yourself out of that, it just bums me out, you know? And so really trying to try to bring this message home of like, you know, we can do this. This is possible. The Buddha was not teaching big fancy ideas. This is like really, but then again, it's really hard work and you got to do all the work, you know? This is the other thing too, I think, that gets confused. It's like if you put Buddhism on a world stage with all the other religions, it sticks out like a sore thumb. Because most religions follow a salvific point of view, which is this idea that there's something out in the universe, call it God, be it what you will, that will kind of save us. Which I don't like that at all. I'm not interested in that. I don't feel like I want to be saved because that's very disempowering. For me, Dharma practice is not—it's not about salvation. It's about redemption. It's about like, you know what, man? I don't need. I can do this. You know, everything I need is inside of me. I have this basic methodology for how I can uncover and I can work through the worst of things, you know? And that is, there's a lot of grit in that. And there's a lot of, you know, and it's also, this isn't a highfalutin idea. This can be done. People have been doing it for 2,500 years. People go through really, really difficult experiences and they come out the other side by doing a practice that seemingly, you know, pretty simple. And so that brings me kind of to where I want to kind of give us some methodology for how this might work, which is thinking about the Four Noble Truths in a different kind of sense. Maybe for some of you are probably familiar with the work of Stephen Batchelor, who I think has done the best job of reframing the Four Noble Truths in a way where they're a lot more, they're more task oriented rather than kind of descriptions of how reality operates. And the other thing that's also interesting about the human experience is, you know, we use terms like skillful and unskillful, or wholesome and unwholesome, or destructive and constructive. But in a clinical sense, the way we would think about it is that As human beings, we can develop views and opinions and behaviors that are very adaptive. And adaptive behaviors and views and opinions are ways in which we adapt to the world so that we can flourish as human beings. We are actually very adaptive human beings. The problem is, if we're not guided by some methodology, we develop not adaptive behaviors, views, and opinions, but maladaptive. Like addiction is a maladaptive behavior. Most mental health disorders are maladaptive. They're maladaptive because they don't work. They're dead ends, as the Buddha calls them. They just go round and round. Like anxiety is really not that helpful. Depression, not that helpful. A lot of these cognitive disorders, as they're called, they're maladaptive because they just go round and round and they don't help us with anything. Now, adaptive, or we would say skillful, kusala, not kusala, the thing that sort of makes this so challenging for many of us is the way that the Buddha articulates what's called dukkha, which I think is a tragically misunderstood term, but the way that he talks about dukkha in the sense of the five aggregates that we have this, we basically, another way to say that is we are human beings, we have equipment, right? We have, you know, we have these bodies, we have these nervous system, we have feelings, we have affect, we have pleasure, we have pain, we have a mental apparatus that can have attitudes of greed and hatred and confusion. And we have thoughts and we have ideas that move through the world. You know, we all have the same equipment. We all have these same five aggregates, as they're called. Now, the equipment is not inherently good or bad. So to say that people are inherently good, I think, is a misstatement. Not to say that people are inherently bad is a misstatement. People are just inherently can go a variety of ways, right? The system, another way to say that is the system, the aggregate system is ethically neutral, right? It just depends on how the conditioning, how the world goes to town on us and how we respond to that. But the good thing is that you can teach an old dog new tricks. So a lot of people that I work, you know, people who have been traumatized drug addicts for 40 years, you know, they get clean, they get sober, they learn some new behaviors and they end up having like these amazing lives. Like, you can rewrite the story at any time. Like, you have the pen. You can rewrite the story at any time. And what it boils down to, and this is just kind of, I thank Stephen for this because I'm stealing his ideas, but it's been really, really helpful to me as somebody who is a traumatized drug addict, frankly, and spent most of my life living in the hell dimensions of my own mind, that dukkha, that trauma, that pain that I went through, when I come into Buddhism and I hear that you can put an end to it, the end of dukkha, I think that's a miscalculation. It's not about whether dukkha ends or doesn't end. It's really actually a relational game. So if we just kind of keep dukkha simple and we just call it something simply like pain, you know, what is my relationship to pain? What is my relationship to discomfort? What is my relationship to trauma? What is my relationship to all of the horrible things that I went through, all of the horrible things that I've seen, and maybe even some of the horrible things that I've done? That's all sitting in this dimension of my heart and mind called dukkha. Now, depending on how I relate or how I adapt or maladapt around that, you know, I mean, addiction is just a maladaptive behavior. It's a dysfunctional relationship to dukkha. You know, Gabor Mate got a lot of trouble for this in his first book, but he wrote that addiction is the ultimate act of self-love. And it's because I'm in so much pain and so much fear and so much confusion. The only thing that I can do that gives me any relief is to stick a needle in my arm. And I get that relief, you damn well better believe that's what I'm gonna do. Because when we just, mostly it's just confused. We don't know what to do with this pain and this difficult experience. So we do whatever we learn how to do. You know what I mean? We don't live in a world where people really show us how to do much. You know, we try to consume our way out of it, you know? And so this addiction, again, also too, addiction gets a deservedly bad reputation, probably because it should, But we all, everybody here, I don't care. I guarantee you everybody here is doing something a little bit more than they wish they were doing it. Is there anything that you do in your life you're like, I too much of this? For me, it's like, you know, it's the phone or the fridge. It's looking at stupid shit online or eating junk food, bullshit garbage that's terrible for my body, but it's really pleasant when I'm eating it. You know, and the world is designed this way. This is all by design. You know, the system, you know, the system is kind of rigged against us to become addicts. That's why it's the addiction economy, especially here in America, the consumer capitalistic society that helps very little people. Is just another way to say, capitalism is just a friendlier way to say addiction. How do we capitalize on people's dysfunctional relationship to pain? And you know what? They're doing a pretty goddamn good job. You know, and I've been doing it for 30 years, and I'm still like struggling with it, man. You know, when you have no skills or no abilities. So then when we can kind of strategize around this, well, what do we do with this dukkha experience? We really just need to embrace it. And that's what it says in the discourse, is dukkha parinya, to fully know, to fully embrace, to fully understand. Yeah, man, being a human being is hard. You know, there's been a lot of struggle. There's been a lot of pain, a lot of confusion. It's okay. You know, it's okay. Everybody's got some. It normalizes it. And I think that's what the Buddha never speaks. Here's the other thing. The Buddha never speaks in a derogatory or pejorative tone around the word dukkha. He never speaks of dukkha as being bad or wrong or being a problem. He just speaks about it as being there. And then what it boils down to is, how do we relate to that? Do we develop addictive, maladaptive strategies around our pain? Or do we develop ways of understanding it and thriving in spite of it? Right? And so you basically end up with this kind of complicated, kind of almost mathematic equation of like, dukkha is the fixed term. And I either develop reactive, repressive habits around it, and I continue to suffer, or I develop adaptive, nibbonic, skillful ways around it, and I do well. Either way, I mean, every terrible thing in my life that I've ever been through has already happened. Still all there. You know, it doesn't go away. There's no go away. There's no all better now. There's just, how am I living in spite of that? And to me, that's a very honest assessment. I can get behind that idea. I can recover. We could almost say that there's pain, and we can develop addiction around pain, or we can recover. We can, this third noble truth. So that the real deciding factor is this Pali word, this whole territory of the second noble truth: craving, clinging, grasping, fueling, attachment, could all be summed up in the word addiction. That's exactly what it is. Now, or reactivity. The other thing that makes it more complicated is there's two sides of this addictive tendency, what's called tanha, khanda upadana, clinging to the aggregate. Is it, we can react. So addiction has a reactive, impulsive dimension to it. But for a lot of people, it's actually repressive. So we can react around our addiction, or we can repress. People who don't fall into addiction, the workaholic, the people pleaser, the perfectionist, the people who don't react around their feelings and emotions, they smush them down. So it's almost in a way that like non-reaction can almost become a kind of reaction. Oh, my childhood wasn't that bad. Other people had it worse. We minimize, you know, we pretend like it wasn't that bad, even though it was. So see how complicated this can get? Like, we can really react around our pain, but we can also be repressive around it. And I think the people who are repressive around it pay a bigger fee for that service. The one good thing I'll say about being an addict and an alcoholic is, like, the one thing about being a drug addict is, one benefit is you ruin your life pretty goddamn quick. You know, you burn it to the ground pretty fast. you know, and then you have all the, then you have this opportunity to have a life on the other side of that. But the repressive ones, you know, the shame, the workaholics, the people pleasers, you know, the perfectionists, that kind of repressive strategy, you can do that for a long, long time and you can get rewarded for that shit. If you're a workaholic, overachiever, people pleaser, you're going to get rewarded in the marketplace. The capitalistic society, corporate America, they're going to pay you for that. You're going to get paid for that service. It's almost worse. So we really are best suited by, you know, for me, it's really all about honesty. Which is also interesting, right? The word noble truth, which I think is poorly translated. Arya Sacha is the word, Arya Sacha. Arya means noble. We can put that aside. That's actually a very much a class system thing. It's actually the Buddha poking fun at religion in ancient India, really, is what he's doing. But this word Sacha, truth, doesn't mean like the truth. Sacha is a virtue of truthfulness. People who are nobly, the noble truthers, us, are people who are willing and able to be honest with themselves. It's about being honest with yourself. It's not about knowing the truth. It's about, you know, how honest can I be with myself about how hard shit has been? I mean, why do we go to therapy? Why do we pay $250 an hour to go sit in a therapy office? What do? We just sit in there and we just give a big dissertation about all the horrible shit we went through. We got to pay good premiums for that stuff. Or we got to sit in a room and someone's got to wave their fingers in front of us. Or we got to hold these rocks that vibrate. We do all kinds of weird shit. And it's all good. I do it too. But I think there's a lot of work that can be done as an individual where we just like, yeah, like we just own it. Instead of trying to strategize around it. Right. And then when we do this, of course, we experience the third noble truth. We can be honest about the ways in which we already feel free. We feel liberated, which I know those words sometimes they're elevated too much. Like liberation for me sounds like an event that I'm not going to experience. I'm like, liberation, that sounds like woo. That's how I got there with enlightenment. But the word nibbana or ceasing, it's just like when the addiction falls away. You know, you can't keep your tantrum up forever. I noticed that when, and I'll pause here and take some questions, but I have a son who's in the other room who's six now, but when he was like 2 years old, I used to drive him around in my truck in the little, we used to call it the little death seat in the back, because he'd throw tantrums in the car, because he'd want me to go left and I went right, or I didn't stop at the dollar store, I didn't do something he wanted, and he would freak out in his little car seat, he'd be screaming, you're the worst dad ever, I hate you, it was just like, you know what? But he can only keep it going for like a couple minutes. You know, 2 or 3 minutes goes by and he comes out of it. Like we don't keep it going forever. So we want to experience the ceasing of that. We want to experience the fall away. And we want to move into this, what's called Nibbana, this non-reactive, non-repressive dimension of our experience. So that way we can, you know, cultivate this Eightfold Path. We can live in the world. We can both and it. We can both understand. We can both understand that there's a lot of problems in the world. You know, there's a lot of horrible shit going on. You know, there's a lot of struggles that people face. Yes, 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 yes. And I'm allowed to be happy in spite of all that. Right? It's just like DBT skill. It's like either both and or yes and. Yes, all those things are true. And you know what? Like, I'm still going to enjoy my breakfast. I'm still going to enjoy my coffee. I'm still going to take my kids to Target and let them buy a bunch of stupid shit. You know, I'm still going to live in the world because I'm not going to let that external experience rob me or steal my freedom and my happiness. And to me, that's like very, and I'll say this, my favorite quote, I get a lot of mileage out of it, but to me, that's just a badass move. You know, that's a lot of like courage and a lot of redemption and a lot of like, you know what? I don't want to hear the noise. You know, Albert Camus says the only way to deal with an unfree world, and I don't know about you, but the world looks pretty unfree to me right now. The only way to deal with an unfree world is to be so completely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. So you want to be rebellious? You want to create positive change in the world? You want to be an activist? Be content. Be happy. Be kind. Be generous. That's the ultimate form of rebellion, is well-being. Because I'll tell you what, I know we're not in all in America, so I'm always speaking from my limited point of view. If there's one thing corporate capitalistic America does not want, is a population of content individuals. That is bad for the bottom line. So what do? They hack into our hearts. They come into our attention. They get and we let them in. We fucking let them in through that phone. And we get all worked up and we get all reactive. And what do? You end up buying some Vans off the internet. Or it happens to me all the time. I always end up buying something, which is exactly what they want. You know what I mean? As they say, I'll get off my high horse here in a minute. I'm sorry. As they say in Silicon Valley, and Tristan Harris's work, the Center for Humane Technology. If you're not familiar with the Center for Humane Technology, check it out. They have a podcast called The Undivided Attention. If the product is free, if the app that you are downloading is free, you are the product. Okay? So think about that for a second. If the product is free, you're the product. So you think you're getting all these free apps? You ain't getting these free apps. There's no free apps. They're just selling your attention. Right? Viva la resistance, right? We can do this. So I'm going to pause there. I have a little bit of time. Thank you, everybody, for your kind attention. And I'm happy to take any... can't say that I'm going to have any answers, but I'd love to hear some questions if you have them. I'd also love to hear, like, how are you dealing with this? I suspect y'all know what I'm talking about. So you can pop your hand up or you can put something in the chat. It'd be nice to see some come on screen. But if you go down to React at the bottom, you can put your hand up. So that'd be cool. All right, Raphael, please, thank you for kicking us off.
Viva la resistance, my friend. I love it, man. I just want to say thank you, Dave. Thank you for what you do. I mean, thank you for throwing out your back and showing us the internal work that you're putting down. With all love, I'm saying that, you know, and everyone here that we share in the sangha. It's been the difference that made it to my world, to community, to come together, to share these spaces. And one of my practices, biggest practices, is my 16-year-old son, you know, in his world. So the Nibbana, my friend, I take that so much. So thank you, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you, man. It's good to see you, bro. Bartek, is that right? Cool name. I think you're on mute too, Bartek.
Okay, I got it now. Hi, Dave.
Hey, bud.
Hi, nice to meet you. Yeah, well done on your stopping your addiction. So that's a great, great, you know, move in your life, you know. So how did that happen? Just curious here.
Suffering. You know, yeah. It's just... You know, it just stopped working. You know, I wasn't getting any relief out of it, and it wasn't easy. But you know, I think, you know, when things start to kind of bite back, it makes it a little easier when the addictions really stop working. All of them stop working for some folks, so it's really, really hard. That's why I have found, maybe it's because of the space I occupy, but like the people I work with, students I work with, people who have addiction in their background really kick ass at Dharma practice because there's a lot of skin in the game. They like know what's going to happen if they don't do it. So there's like the conviction that a lot of times people have who have addiction backgrounds is really, really amazing. They end up doing really, really good in a practice like this because they know the consequence.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Well, You kick here something really interesting. Yeah, I'm keep forgetting about this Four Noble Truths, and this is probably the biggest and the most important part of Buddhist, you know, teachings here. And the second one, especially, you know, the second one is, I think it's that the suffering, you know, or pain or whatever should be understood. I think it also should be felt, and that's where I find this relief, really, you know, and it works. It more alive for me, like in a feeling it, you know, then I can actually let go. Because otherwise, just by, you know, thinking about it, it's quite hard, you know, sometimes to just let go of the addictions, you know, of something that the habit is deeply, deeply ingrained.
Yeah.
So that just, is that you finding practical as well, you know, with that double truth, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money with that. It's the feeling. You know, it's liberation. I mean, that's even part of the Buddhist system is liberation through feeling. It's like, oh, I can actually be in pain and not medicate my pain. Like I can, it's resilience. It's like, I can actually handle a lot more than I thought I could, you know? And it's like, and we can adapt around pain. And when you adapt around pain in adaptive ways, that's called resilience. And we start to actually get an appetite for that. We're like, oh, what else can I, you know, what else can I do that I didn't think I could do? And to me, that's a great learning mechanism. It's like, you know, and that's a lot of strength in that. There's a lot of courage in that. There's a lot of empowerment in that. It's like, yeah, like I can do hard things. I didn't know I could do hard things.
Yeah, that's so true. And that will take us to this third noble truth, I think, you know, which is letting go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's doing something hard and realizing it didn't kill you. You're like, wow, that was really hard, but I'm okay now. And then you start, yeah, exactly. That's that Nibbanic sense is like, you come out the other side a better person. And then you start to develop a healthy appetite for that. You
that's
know?
That's right. Like, healthy habits as well, you know? That we
yeah, that's
them.
Right. Yep, that's exactly right.
And that's where the courage, I think, will come from as well, from this experience that we can gain, you know, on the small things and then go to the bigger ones. And
that's right.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah. You're inspiring, you know, to me. So nice to meet you as well.
You too, man. Thanks for popping in. It's always good to see someone have the courage to jump on the screen.
All the best. Cheers. Thank you.
How about Samantha?
Hello. Nice meeting you, and really thank you for that session. That was really on point, and I really needed to hear that today. I don't know, the timing was just so perfect. Because I was thinking about how I can be addicted to my own thoughts because I really identify myself to my thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And it gives,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it gave me peace knowing that, you know, it's a feeling, but you don't have to be so attached to your thoughts, and there's something better out of this. So, anyways, that was my small parenthesis. And then it made me think because, I saw that you play guitar. I see the guitarist in the background, mm-hmm. and I play music too. And for a while, music was my outlet to just express the pain I had. And I just wanted to know you personally, how you use music to help yourself. Was it part of the journey, or you use something else to just, you know, express your trauma in healthy ways instead of just overthinking and not do anything productive about it?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's a really complicated question for me because music has been a tremendous source of suffering and disappointment for me.
Yeah.
And it's also been the greatest sense of joy and meaning for me. So all my shit's tied up into music. And so for me, music is the ultimate meaning-making machine. You know what I mean? I can tell a really painful story about something that I went through a song without you really knowing what I, you know what I mean? It's like you can be sneaky in a song.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the emotion out without having to describe everything in a way. So for me, and also I like to play other people's music. I just feel like music is like emotional health for me. You know, and it allows me to process all of the emotions, not just the good ones. So it's like you know, like my songs in a minor key, right? They're like life. Dukkha is the minor key of life. You know what I mean? And who doesn't love a good song in a minor key? We love minor key songs. Why? Because they're meaningful. They mean something. It basically gives it, I went through hard things, but you know what? It doesn't have to necessarily, it can be meaningful in a way that's beautiful, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting because for me, I don't know, for my relationship with music is kind of the same relationship I have sometimes with pain. And sometimes I don't want to express my pain, so I don't play music. But the moment that I realize that pain is part of the game and you can't really escape it, it brings a deeper meaning to the music I do, because instead of just having those thoughts and just suppress emotions and just feel bad about it, at least you're doing something productive and other people can relate with your pain. So it's kind of a gift at the same time. But yeah, I just wanted to know how other people are relating to music, because it's such a personal thing for me, but music is such a human thing and it's a translation of other things too. So yeah, thanks for answering.
I mean, if you look at world, I mean, every culture since time immemorial uses music. I mean, it's a human thing. It's like pain processing center, you know? So I think it's great. You know, it's been a huge part of my life, and it's been complicated too. But yeah, I think that music is so, such a great Dharma practice.
Mm-hmm. True that. Nice. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. How about Jerome? I think I see a hand there.
Well, thank you, Dave. I've really enjoyed the meditation, and also I really enjoyed your ramblings. I like the way you presented the dukkha and nirvana and the five aggregate, the kleshas. It just gives me a whole new perspective on the whole thing. It just has a lighter feeling than the texts and the other teachers I've been with have taught. So it's really sweet. Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. That means the world. I appreciate that. I spent a lot of time thinking. All I do is think about this stuff.
Yeah. I've been teaching mindfulness and healing for about 16 years now.
Nice.
And to have that loose perspective.
Yeah.
Is really good, because you can't be attached to the outcome when you're doing mindfulness and healing.
I agree. Thanks, Jerome. It's nice to meet you, man.
Thank you.
Take a look at the chat. Yes, how about RP?
Hi, Dave. I don't have anything really to say, but I was just quite moved by your talk, so I just felt compelled to say hello.
Oh, thank you.
Also, like, I loved how you talked about the attention economy, and it'd be really, really cool if it could be like a counter movement to that, and it could be like a systematic thing that people can learn in a systematic way. Because it sounds like, because I've come across a couple of apps that are free, I'm not going to talk about them, that are starting to do this kind of thing, and I think that can go, that can become like normal, that'd be really nice. Yeah, thank you once again.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for saying that. I appreciate it. We have a bit of time left. Don't be shy. There's got to be some questions between 80 people from around the world.
Is there a question in the chat there, Dave? From Judith, any practical advice on how to use the phone less when feeling lonely?
Yeah, that's a, yeah. Well, you know, nothing good is ever going to happen to you on a screen. That's kind of my feeling. You know, it's hard now because we've been they call it social. It's like, there's nothing social about a phone. Antisocial media is really what it is. You know, it's just trying to find another person, like, you know, reach out, call somebody, meet somebody on here. You'd be surprised. People are really happy when you want to connect with them. People really, I think a lot of people feel this way, and it's nice. It's nice to do that. The other thing to do is, like, when, you know, loneliness only has one problem, and that it's lonely. And usually I find when I experience loneliness is I'm trying to disconnect from part of myself. So I've found that just having a metta practice for self is really, really helpful in that capacity, where you like really kind of appreciate the company that you keep in the privacy of your own mind. But we don't need a ton of people. One or two people is really, really great. One thing I want to say too that I forgot to mention about Donna, just reframe it, is, you know, one thing I really respect about Selma Live, amongst many things, is how much work that goes into this, and that these groups are freely offered, and that anybody can come on these Sundays regardless of their financial situations, as is the Dharma lineage. And so, you know, if you're able to support this meeting, this Sangha Live, the work that you do, please do it. Now is a great time. There's nothing better. I love practicing generosity myself because it helps me with my fear around money and stuff. And so, you know, if you are able, if your conditions are so that you're able to offer some financial support, you can click on the thing and do so. Also, they split the money that they take in for these Sundays gets split between Sangha Live and the teachers. So I really appreciate it. Most of what I do is for Donna. I also like Donna because it's totally anti. It's totally everything I said today. It's anti, man. It's like, you know, it's the Donna economy, the generosity economy. And it's really, really great because it supports, you know, other people. And if you look at their website, they do this all the time. And so please don't hesitate to support, you know, local communities and make an investment in the Dharmaverse, because this is really what people need right now. So thank you for all that you're able to do. Okay. Oh yeah, arguing about, yeah. I mean, I hear you, Kate. I navigate this all the time out here in Little Rural Colorado, you know. I'll give you a little hack on this one that I use a lot. It's a DBT trick called yes and. So if somebody's like telling me about Trump's doings and how they're going to be good, I don't disagree. I just go, yeah. I just say yes until they're done. And then I go, and see, yes and is a really, really great way to avoid conflict in an argument, because you're not saying no, you're not disagreeing with them. You're just, you know, it's yes and. You know, and sometimes that can be very, very helpful, because it's hard not to clash on views. So, you know, it's hard for people. Some people like to argue. I don't. So I like this yes and. You know what I mean? I'll do all kinds of weird, dishonest things to get out of an argument, because I just don't find it to be very pleasant. And the yes and has been a godsend for me. You know. So, yeah, try that one. And, you know, there'll be times where you'll get too worked up and, you know, you're not going to get it right all the time. But, you know, like one of the things that we cling to, that we're addicted to, is, you know, views and opinions. You know? So it's just trying to put that aside. You know? There's a great story in the Zen tradition where these two, back in the day, I can imagine they used to have these like big Dharma debates, and the Zen masters would debate each other on these philosophical analytics. And one of them, the guy said, I forget who it was, one of the Zen masters said, I hold no views, so I cannot be refuted. And that was it. He won. So, you know, hold no views, and you cannot be argued with. So, yeah, we're just about out of time. I'm going to go. My wife and my 12-year-old went to basketball camp, so my sister's here with my son, who's sick, so I'm going to go chase him around the yard. So I hope you do something pleasant and enjoyable for yourself today. Yeah, and don't let the world bring you down, man. Be better than media. As George Carlin, the late, great George Carlin said, it's all bullshit and it's bad for you. You know?
Thanks so much, Dave.
All right, y'all.
Thanks for being with us today. That was great.
My pleasure.
And to everyone, to let you know, if you would like to join, we've got daily meditations starting tomorrow with our teacher, Ayala Gill. She'll be leading every morning European time, so 8 a.m. And if you're in the U.S., the recording is available like about an hour afterwards. And she's leading a practice on the body as a doorway to love. So kind of continuing on with the meta themes, if you want to explore meta more, come join us for that and sit with community for the whole week. I'm putting the link in to sign up if anyone would like to join. Hope to see you there.
I put my website in there if you want to find out more of what I do. I got a bunch of free stuff online, or if you email me, I'll get back to you. I'm pretty good like that.
Take care, everyone.
Cheers, y'all.